Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated, a weekly roundup of the who's who and the what's what in the arts and culture scene here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture reporter. Each week, we'll bring you conversations and stories about notable happenings in our little slice of the world. Today on Curated, we speak with the president and CEO of PBS.
You know, the consumer, the viewer, is overwhelmed with an avalanche of viewing experiences.
We hear from an actor who's looking to end youth incarceration.
I'm looking for people who have something to say that they would scream from a mountaintop, and I just happen to be walking by.
We hear from author Ethan Kanan, and we go to the Aspen Ideas Festival to hear about how one man is making music and instruments.
We used to make beats by, like, banging on tables in the lunchroom and, like, rap over that, and so just like I was thinking about, like, well, what are the other ways that people can make music without having to buy an instrument or take a class? And so I thought about using materials and making their own.
All of that, plus our song of the week, and as always, The Week in the Arts, a quick rundown of the top things to see, hear, and experience this week in the Valley. That's all coming up on Curated from Aspen Public Radio News. Paula Kerger took on the role of president and CEO of PBS 10 years ago. Since then, the media landscape has changed entirely. There's video streaming. The needs and habits of viewers have changed. I spoke with her last week during a stop at the Aspen Ideas Festival about the future of PBS and the challenges she's facing today. Now, as I understand, you've been the CEO and president of PBS for 10 years now.
Yes.
I wonder how public media has changed in your time at PBS.
Well, you know, the last 10 years has been just a swirl in terms of the change in media itself. When I came to PBS 10 years ago, iTunes announced that they were going to sell episodes of Desperate Housewives for $1.99, and it sounded so strange. And of course, now we live in an environment where it's the expectation that you can access anything you want when you want it. And so the technology has really, I think, driven a whole different understanding of how media organizations relate to their viewers.
And I feel like, especially with brands like PBS, like NPR, there is the expectation that they exist and rely solely on their terrestrial media. And brands like iTunes, you said, that was selling Desperate Housewives, they exist from the beginning on the internet. I wonder if you feel like you need to pivot or change your brand at all to accommodate that.
No, in fact, I think brands matter more now in this environment than ever, because in part the consumer, the viewer, is overwhelmed with an avalanche of viewing experiences. And I think when you look at powerful brands like NPR and PBS that have been established over decades and really represent quality and a certain type of content, it really is a helpful element in helping people make content decisions. Look, you know, we're awash now in media options. Our audiences actually on broadcast television have grown. And so if you look just from a Nielsen basis, our audiences have gone up over the last few years, not gone down. And I think in part because of our focus on the integrity of the content. So you've asked me what changed, but what also stays the same? And I think that relentless commitment to content that we hope is entertaining, but that also is educational, inspirational, is that through line that I think draws people. But I also think this new technology and the ability for people to watch on a demand basis, but then also come into a broadcast basis.
Now, there's the perception in public media in general that as a whole, the people who work in it and the people who watch it, it's getting older and whiter. And I wonder what you're doing to combat that perception.
So our organization is probably more diverse, both in terms of the people working at PBS as well as the audience that we're pursuing, than I think in any time in our history. If you pull apart public television, because we are a little different than NPR in this regard, we are a variety service. So we spend 8 hours a day focused on viewers under the age of 8. And that has always been a hugely diverse audience. In fact, we over-index in homes without cable and homes without computer. We over-index in homes where English may not be a first language. And I think that as we've looked at the programs themselves, we've always tried to make sure that the programs are reflecting a range of viewer experiences and backgrounds. I think in prime time and in the work that we're doing, yes, television itself, broadcast television tends to be older, but I think we've seen that through the ways that we've thought about the programming that we're bringing forward, there is a growing appetite for independent film. We're the largest home of independent film on television. And so I think that this is a space where we're bringing in a more diverse audience, but frankly, that's, again, coming back to the whole question of digital platforms. Within PBS, our digital team is younger, it is more diverse, and the stories that we're producing reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned grabbing kids when they're young. I watched PBS when I was little. I know lots of people did, but I still feel like maybe there's that gap where after that period, maybe you lose them. What's your strategy to getting them to latch back on? You have these digital strategies.
So in fact, when we started our work in digital studios, I actually thought that it was going to be more of a millennial strategy. I thought that, you know, we were observing that more people were cord cutters or cord nevers and that we're spending more time on, you know, on digital platforms. And in fact, when we started putting some of our content on places like Hulu and Netflix and Xbox and others, it was a way of connecting content that we knew would be of interest to a younger audience, but perhaps they weren't thinking of PBS as the place where they were going to spend time. And so, you know, like specifically, we looked at Hulu as a place because we knew that it had a very large younger male audience for a lot of science content, for example, which tends to attract a male audience. And so I think that, you know, again, through the work that we've done on YouTube, we actually have found that we're aging down into, you know, sort of tweens and teens and, you know, sort of young 20s. So it's a slightly different audience than I thought we would attract, who's interested in smart, fast-paced content. Content we can share out because of the what we know about that audience. We know it's also being used by teachers in schools because of, again, the structure of it, where you're dealing with shorter form content. It just lends itself very well to that.
Individual giving versus large donors contributing to nonprofit media organizations. Recently, NPR was in the news over a controversy regarding the Plowshares Fund, which, as it turns out, had donated to NPR, and simultaneously they were involved in the Iran nuclear deal and kind of caused a kerfuffle. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you address people's concerns about large donors, large corporations coming in with large donations, and how people might perceive that as influencing PBS's news coverage.
So the strength of I'll comment on our own philanthropy. I know a bit about public radio as well, but you would probably be better suited to comment on that. I think on the television side, the base of our support has always been lots of small contributions, and you know, the amount of philanthropy coming into public television that's more in the major gift side has been relatively modest but growing, and I think that the amount of corporate philanthropy has also been not as large as people anticipate. I think that people always comment to me about the fact that, you know, you have all these, donors that are coming in, and wouldn't it be more efficient if you had, you know, some big philanthropy that would, you know, fund public media? And I think the reality is that the fact that we are so reliant on community-based fundraising, so this is the argument for the fundraising drives, by the way, is that it keeps us anchored in community and it keeps us accountable. And I think that people are smart and they can discern where there is influence or perceived influence. And I think that that really forces us to really pay attention. And when we do have moments where we may accept a gift that people may question, I think it's really up to us to, you know, constantly scrutinize, because I believe absolutely there's firm firewalls between philanthropy and editorial. I know it. I live it every day. We have an ombudsman that is very active, that that looks at these issues constantly, both at the station level as well as at PBS. But occasionally you may miss something, and you may accept a gift that there perhaps is the perception. And I think we just need to be very scrupulous about paying attention to that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
That was Paula Kirger, president and CEO of PBS. You're listening to Curated from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. Follow Aspen Public Radio on Twitter or Instagram, or like us on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick B. Fort. A small seminar at the Aspen Ideas Festival last week made a bit of noise. I went to explore what was going on.
That beatbox is important. That is, for me, that's how I learned how to play the drums.
Akil Charlton traveled from Chicago to Aspen and had a shopping list with him. Soup cans, clear vinyl tubing, some balloons, and painter's tape.
I believe one is 7/8 of an inch diameter, one is 5/8 of an inch diameter, and the other is...
Charlton grew up in Chicago. He didn't have access to music lessons when he was a kid for a bunch of reasons. So he learned music by making his body an instrument.
We used to make beats by like banging on tables in the lunchroom and like rap over that.
And then he became a drummer and electronic musician. Then he had a question.
What are the other ways that people can make music without having to buy an instrument or take a class? And so I thought about using materials and making their own.
And that's what the things on his shopping list are for. Soup cans for bongos. Or vinyl tubing saxophones. Charlton runs a program in Chicago to bring music to students who wouldn't otherwise be able to access it. Money, transportation.
Because I really think it's important to teach like how we can naturally make music and make art.
Just as a human.
Yeah, as a human, like without any instruments. Like so I teach a lot of call and response. We teach like old like hand clap games, like the ones you used to learn on the playground, or like maybe your parents used to learn on the playground.
And making these instruments is just one way to expand that vision a little bit. In this seminar, the dozen attendees made a bongo out of soup cans with a balloon stretched over it like a drum head. Then the mouthpiece of the balloon was put onto some vinyl tubing to make it like a primitive saxophone. Charlton goes to participating schools twice a week during the course of the program.
If you want to, you know, start to develop the skills of like a percussionist or a horn player or something, then here are some simple instruments that could at least get you in that direction.
He incorporates his music education programs into his own live performances, as well as runs an alternative music ensemble in the Chicago public school system. If you missed part of today's show, go online to aspenpublicradio.org, where you can subscribe to the Curated podcast.
April, come she will. When streams are ripe and swelled with rain,
Anna Deavere Smith is known for her roles on The West Wing and Nurse Jackie. Right now, she's working on two projects that address poverty, education, and youth incarceration. She spoke with Aspen Public Radio News Director Carolyn Zachariasen.
I have a theater project called On the Road, A Search for American Character, and I've made 18 plays in which I deal with usually really social justice events. And I interview people, and then I play many, many parts in a one-person show. So my goal has been to put myself in other people's words the way you would put yourself in other people's shoes, and really to try to absorb America word for word.
Your project is called Pipeline, but once you explained that calling it anything else may not entirely be accurate. Let's listen to an excerpt, then I'll ask you to elaborate.
I think it's unfair to call this the school-to-prison pipeline or the school-to-prison pipeline, because it seems to blame schools and teachers for something that's much, much bigger.
What is it? What's bigger?
Poverty. I think that not just because of poverty, not just because of racism, not just because of inequality, not just because our public schools are in a mess and we are in a midst of trying to turn around the kind of mass incarceration that we have. I'm not some liberal making this up. United States Justice Department released statistics that show that Black, Brown, Native American poor kids are punished more harshly. They're suspended and expelled more often than middle-class kids are, and that at a certain age, these suspensions and expulsions pretty much predict they're certainly going to be in the juvenile justice system or have some kind of relationship to it, and very likely they'll be caught in these cycles of mass incarceration that many people in our country are concerned about.
How do you choose which interviews you will take and put out there?
Some of it is I have to, in this, I'm not really telling a story. I'm trying to illuminate an issue. It's complex, there are many facets of it, right? So, for example, you know, if I talk to a psychiatrist who talks to me about trauma, as Victor Carrion does, then when I go inside to a OH Close, a juvenile prison, and I ask his kids, you know, Stephen Campos, what about trauma? And he tells me it's, you know, what that we can't say on the air.
Right.
Then, hey, the two of them are going to be in the show. But it's also that I'm looking for people who have something to say that they would scream from a mountaintop, and I just happen to be walking by.
You steal my bicycle, so I had to walk 20 city blocks in the rain.
This week's guest for First Draft is Ethan Kanan, author of A Doubter's Almanac. The book tells the story of Milo Andret, a brilliant mathematician and a terrible alcoholic. The novel explores ambition and destructiveness, obsession and ruin. In this segment, Ethan Kanan tells host Mitzi Rapkin via Skype about how he begins a new work.
I've been teaching for a long time, and I've learned in my 20 years of teaching about 15 things about writing. One of the more important ones is that it's much easier to plot your way into an idea than it is to idea your way into a plot. So I never start with an idea or a question. I always start with misbehavior. That's what makes books go, is people acting wrong. That's what books are. That's what novels are, is compendiums of misbehavior and its consequences. So I just sort of put people out there and make him do bad things and see what happens. And then the question comes. Like, I didn't even know this guy, the narrator or the ostensible narrator of this book, was going to be a mathematician till 30 or 40 pages into it.
So did you start with a certain misbehavior?
Yeah. This is the only book I've written 7 books now. This is the only book I've ever written in which the first scene, or the scene I started with, remained the first scene in the book. And this is the scene of this guy looking out the window when his old rival drives up with his old lover, who's now the lover of the rival. And so the narrator sees that and goes through a sort of elaborate set of fakery to show how robust he is and blah, blah, blah. So that was sort of the initial misbehavior.
Do you think because in some ways he was in a no-win relationship with his math, that his addiction mirrored that, like in some way he needed something that was also a no-win situation that wasn't math?
Interesting. I like that no-win situation. Everyone's in a no-win situation, really, with any kind of creativity. You know, all books are imperfect. All books, you know, have their own sine wave of hope and despair. You kind of learn that over a course of writing many of them. And that you have to sort of transform your hope for the win into sort of reverence for the truth, reverence for complex grief and sadness and happiness and ecstasy that fill all our lives. I think when I was younger, I used to try to write books that were beautiful and that people would love. And now, as I get older, I try to write books that I feel are true. It's part of that no-win thing, because you realize you can't win, so you might as well be honest, right?
So what's the truest thing for you about this book?
Truest thing for me about this book is kind of what you just said, the no-win thing, that any kind of endeavor is a no-win situation. life is a no-win situation. You can't win it. You can only have good innings. And he has a few good innings and a few bad innings. I think that's the way it turns out for most people. You know, we all face the death of our parents, our own deaths, illness. We also all, or most of us, get to walk out in the woods and ski in Aspen. So that's, I guess, the truth. All novels are about writing a novel. Which is, you know, and this novel, sure, is about writing a novel. It's about the difficulty of trying some useless thing that takes a gargantuan feat of discipline and hopefulness and, you know, hoping for the win, although you know the win is not going to take place. There's no such thing as the win.
So I read somewhere that you said this was the hardest book that you've written. Is that because you're more conscious of these things, or was it just the actual mechanics of getting this done?
Well, the first 300 pages are pretty easy for me. I might not be dividing it properly, but the first half of the book was pretty easy for me. I never have a good time writing, but I had not a terrible time writing that. There's enough misbehavior and enough wild things this guy does that it was a pleasure to write. And, you know, he was rapacious enough and lawless enough that it was a pure pleasure to imagine myself that guy. Second half was much harder. And also the third, fourth, fifth time through it, I had to get the math right. So I just guessed on all the math most of the way through. And then ended up finding, of all things, a retired mathematician in my little town of Iowa City who happened to be a topologist, which is what Milo Andret is. And so this insanely generous man, his name is John Simon, and I couldn't thank him enough in the back of the book, read this, you know, 600-page manuscript and wrote me about 50 to 60 pages of notes on the math. And I spent about a year getting the math right.
That was Ethan Kanan, the author of A Doubter's Almanac. He spoke with First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin over Skype. To hear their entire conversation, go online to aspenpublicradio.org. Happy July 4th. This is Curated on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. For today's Song of the Week, we've gone with 4th of July by Sufjan Stevens from one of my favorite albums of 2015, Carrie and Lowell.
Hospital asked, Should the body be cast before I say goodbye, my star in the sky? Such a funny thought to wrap you up in cloth. Do you find it all right, my dragonfly? Shall we look at the moon, my little loon? Why do you cry? Make the most of your life while it is rife, while it is light.
That was 4th of July by Sufjan Stevens. It's Monday, July 4th, and this is The Week in the Arts, an abbreviated list of the upcoming events and happenings in the Valley. Independence Day. If you're not watching the action movie of the same name or seeing the sequel, check out 4th of July events up and down the valley. Aspen Film is screening the film Wiener on Wednesday. It follows the scandal of politician Anthony Wiener. Dave Jordan plays on Thursday's Snowmass Free Concert. The Aspen Santa Fe Ballet's summer performances open on Friday. Crazy Mix and the Love Child opens at the Art Base in Basalt. The mixed media art is made by Andrew Roberts Gray. The Glenwood Springs Center for the Arts Hip Hop Exhibition opens on Friday. Theater Aspen's Buyer and Seller opens on Saturday. It's directed by Aspen Word's Mo LeMay. Come to the 2016 Garden Tour in Glenwood Springs. The event is a self-guided tour of 8 gardens chosen for their visual appeal and creativity. Young the Giant performs at the Belly Up on Sunday. This is Curated, a weekly show dedicated to arts and culture. I'm Patrick Fort at the Ed Lisneason Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.